In this interview, we talk with David DeFord. He was a hippie at 18, converted to the gospel at 19, and a bishop at 22.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Hey, this is the Leading LDS Podcast. You made it back. Or maybe it's your first time. If it is your first time, what Leading LDS is, it's an online platform. We have a website, if you go to leadinglds.org, or a podcast, which you're listening to now. And we try to enhance the leadership ability in the context of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And we do that by interviewing interesting people, experts, authors, and sometimes whoever will be willing to sit down and give their opinion. And it's fascinating, the things we learn. Now, I've begun a few emails of people going to leadinglds.org/help because they want to contribute, right? All we ask for at Leading LDS is $1 a month for the content we put out. So generally, I tell you, go to leadinglds.org/help, and there you'll find a link that sends you to our Patreon page so you can donate that dollar a month or more. And hopefully it's easy as that, but I've been told that it's maybe not as easy as that. So I've adjusted that page a little bit. At the very top, you'll see a picture has a dollar bill on it, and it says click here to contribute to Leading LDS, and click there, and there you can submit or contribute your dollar a month to Leading LDS, and I sure appreciate it. We're doing a lot of good with what we're doing. We could definitely use more. And so now in this interview, we talk with David DeFord, and you'll have to pardon me, at the beginning of this, we spend a lot of time with his background. He has an interesting story about being a hippie and hitchhiking across the country and in search for something, some truth. He converts to the gospel and then becomes a bishop 3 years after his conversion at the age of 22. So really fascinating story. I spent a little time there, and we talk about his time serving as bishop 4 different times. So fantastic interview. He knows his stuff. Great perspective. Here's my interview with David DeFord. Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum, and today we're headed down to Omaha, Nebraska to talk with David DeFord. How are you, David?
Doing great.
Good. Well, I appreciate you giving a few minutes of your busy schedule. You're a bishop, and so I know every minute that you can spare is it's hard to come by at times, but I appreciate it. And are you, are you originally from Omaha area?
No, I'm originally from Indiana.
Oh, okay.
I grew up in southern Indiana near Bloomington.
Nice. And
lived all my childhood there.
Great. Great. And you are serving as bishop for your 4th time. Is that right?
Yes. Twice as bishop, twice as branch president.
Okay. Well, and probably the same weight is on the shoulders, regardless of what they call you, mm-hmm. I assume.
No question.
Well, great. And how long have you been serving currently?
Just since November.
Oh, wow.
We formed a new ward. Actually, in our stake, we formed 3 new wards and really divided them up and sliced them small. And so I have a new ward. It's, you know, we just have just a couple hundred people, small
oh,
ward.
Really?
Yeah.
Like just couple hundred people on the rolls.
Yep.
Wow. So what's your average attendance on Sunday?
We get about 110, 120.
Okay. So still a good body that shows up on Sundays. And
yeah.
And so it sounds like you have a pretty good activity rate.
Yep. It's going really well.
Great.
The demographics of the little ward is it's pretty broad. We have several apartment buildings, uh-huh. and then we also have some really nice neighborhoods. So we have a good cross section of
nice. So part of your ward's established, and others the apartment area is a bit transient, I would imagine.
Yeah, and we get a lot of professional students. So we have some law students, some dental students. We have physical therapy, various types of professional students who come in, stay for 3-4 years or so, and then.
Nice. And that's the University of Nebraska in Omaha, right?
Yes, and Creighton University.
Oh, okay.
Particularly Creighton University attracts a lot of the professional students.
Great. And what is it you do to make a living?
I'm a speaker, a trainer, author.
Wow.
I do a lot of leadership coaching, So most of my speaking is centered on leadership development, on taking responsibility. I'm one of those speakers who's kind of in people's faces, and I
nice.
Tell them to quit whining and do something about things.
Nice. So leadership topics and things. So nobody can argue you're on the wrong podcast right now. That's good.
No,
so.
And that's originally what drew me to your podcast.
Well, great. Great. And I'm definitely open for any critiques or analysis as you see fit. But and as we originally connected, you kind of told me about your background and wanted to get to know, you know, just or get your input on your perspective of leadership. But obviously you're out there making it happen. So are you self-employed then, or do you work for a larger company?
Yes, I'm self-employed.
Okay. And so when you say you're a trainer, basically going and doing, live presentations, or is this one-on-one training?
I do both. I do some coaching. Most of what I do is a big group training. So I'll have 60 to 80 people in a seminar. I teach them all day, 6 hour mm-hmm. days.
And what's the typical company that you may help out?
Oh, it really varies. I have a lot of government entities. They're the ones that still have money. We have a lot of
they didn't have printing press, so it's easier.
Yeah. Government, healthcare, and education all seem to still have a lot of training because they're doing fine. Uh-huh. But also a lot of large corporations. I do a lot of public utilities. It's a wide variety.
Nice. And is there a specific type of problem that they want you to come in and address, or is it mainly just general leadership management type of training?
Generally, I'll meet with the organization, find out what are their challenges. So that too is a wide variety. Sometimes it's about leading projects. So your interest in Asana is very interesting to me.
Oh, cool.
Sometimes it's about communication. You know, people are not getting along, but mostly it's people who organizations where they still have kind of an old-timey industrial revolution type of leadership style, and they're trying to update.
Gotcha. Where everybody just sort of a cog on the wheel and do your job and don't ask questions type of approach.
Use them up, throw them away, get some more.
Not very effective, right? Especially in a church setting. Getting more is a bit difficult.
I have seen that, but that's not what we want to do.
Well, that's great. Well, and you say you're an author as well. What type of books, leadership books you've written around these concepts that you teach?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I have a wide variety of that too. I like challenge. I like new things. My wife and I wrote a memoir about how we met each other and our conversion story. I've got one about the Wabash Trace Nature Trail in Iowa. I have several that are essays about living with purpose.
That's great. Well, I'll definitely have to get the link to some of those resources and people can check them out as they listen.
Great.
And speaking of your memoir, I do want to maybe take a step back in your timeline and talk about your upbringing, because the way you described it is you were a hippie early on in life. Is that right?
Yep.
So what about your childhood led you to a hippie lifestyle?
Well, I had a series of setbacks. I really planned to go to college on a basketball scholarship. And
was this like when you were like 8 and you dreamt of this, or were you an actual stellar high school player that was a possibility?
I was a decent high school player. I thought I was going to be better high school player. I kept thinking senior year, boy, that's going to be the time when I'm really going to shine. And I did make the preseason all-state team and all that, but
colleges were not interested.
Peter Principal, I couldn't cut it. I wasn't good enough.
Okay. And so that was devastating to you.
Devastating. It was one of those, I had no plan B.
Oh.
And then, so midway into my senior year, I just kind of fell apart, started doing a lot of bad stuff, a lot of drugs. Mm-hmm. Psychedelics were big then. I graduated in 1970. So it was right in the middle of all the throes of that. I got very involved in LSD and
Yeah.
The mushrooms and all that kind of stuff.
And so that caused you to sort of just run away from your home and your life? And
it's a spiral downward. Yeah. I was going to college and at Indiana University, just doing so much drugs and things that I could not bring myself to go to class. Wow. Midterms were coming up. My parents were going to know that I wasn't even showing up. And a friend of mine said that he was going to dodge the draft and he was going to head to Canada. And I said, well, I'll go with you.
And off you went.
Off we went. We hitchhiked east. We went to Washington, D.C. Actually, my cousins were going to meet us there. They chickened out, but they were bringing the cash, you know. So,
nice. So that was left you in a tough spot when you were in D.C. with no cash.
Yeah. So my friend and I, we kind of lived under the bushes at DuPont Circle and there for a few weeks. Then we connected in. So some people came to panhandle us and we said, we'd like to help, but we don't have any money. We don't even have places to live. And so, yeah. They said, we have a group here. You can come stay with us.
Gotcha. And I guess I need to mention that you were not raised in the church. I mean, that you weren't leaving a Mormon household or any of those types of principles, right?
No, I grew up in a nice, Protestant family. It was a Christian church. It's kind of like Church of Christ. So it's a Campbellite church. So when I see a lot of the teachings of Sidney Rigdon and stuff, that's where he came from. It was the same faith that he came from.
And were your parents pretty devastated when you left home? And I would imagine they would be.
Oh yeah. Especially since I didn't tell them I was leaving and didn't tell them where I was. My mom,
wow.
One of the biggest regrets of my life, because my mom just, almost had a breakdown because,
wow,
you know,
as most mothers probably would, yeah, if their child disappeared. So,
but it is an example of what the drugs will do to a person.
Wow.
You know, you just lose a lot of your rationality.
Oh, wow. And, so when along this journey, did you meet your wife who was also a hippie, right?
Yeah, she was. First off, just let me say, set a little stage here. The group who invited me to stay with them was kind of a religious based hippie group and stuff. And they taught the red letters of the Bible, you know, that only the words of Christ were valid biblical text. And so, you know, I studied it a lot. And I came at one point to in Matthew 5, when it says, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father, which is in heaven." And I looked around and I saw that's not what we're doing here. something's different. And so
they were all talk and no action
And proud of it. And proud of it. And so that night I prayed. I went for a walk by myself because there was no alone time at that place. And I went for a walk and I just prayed and, you know, said, I know you're there and I know that you love me. And, I want to serve you, but I don't know how. And if you want me to stay here, if you want me to go home to Indiana, you know, wherever you want me to go, please show me how to serve you. And that next morning at 7 o'clock or so, there was a knock on the door and somebody had driven overnight from southern Indiana to northern Ohio, where we were at the time, to try to convince me to go home. So I climbed right in the car and went home. About 3 weeks later, I was just on a little errand in my parents' car, picking up some stuff for my mom, and I saw these hitchhikers up ahead in Bloomington and 3rd Street on the side of the road. And so I stopped and picked them up. And since I'd hitchhiked all over the eastern United States and things, I was, you know, we had something in common as two girls. And I took them way out of my way, about a half an hour out of my way or so, and then gave them my phone number, said, if you're coming back through, stop by, we can do your laundry and stuff. And so they came back about a week later, stayed a few days. I got acquainted with them, especially one of them, and they headed west, and they were going to go to a couple cities and told me the names of the people they were going to go see. So if I wanted to catch up with them? I could. So after a couple of days, I told my parents, got to go. I got to find her.
And that was your wife?
That was my wife.
Oh, man.
So
what a love story.
So hitchhiked west, and they were in this little town I'd never heard of called Provo, Utah.
Oh, boy.
Visiting a friend of Kathy's from high school who was LDS. And but she had not completed the journey because she wanted to go to California. She started in Boston, Massachusetts. She started in Cape Cod and was heading, she wanted to go coast to coast. Her friends were tired of it. So she and I took off, headed west. Now, she, before her journey, she had prayed to be led to where she was supposed to go, and she was having kind of a spiritual awakening. There was never any, faith in their home.
Yeah, so she doesn't come from an LDS background either.
No.
Okay.
So along the way, we had a Bible, we were reading, we were searching, we were going to different churches and doing different things, Christian Science Reading Room. We were actively searching for the truth.
And how old were you, would you say you were at this point?
I was 18. She was 19.
Okay.
When we made it back a few months later to Provo, her two friends had joined the church. And so we said, well, we might as well check these people out too. We took the missionary discussions in a week because that's how long we had before we were going to needed to head back across the country to make it back to Massachusetts. Well, we were reading the Bible, or we were reading the Book of Mormon, and taking these missionary discussions. That was at the time when the Provo Temple was actually in its open house stage. So they were having tours. That's how old I am. One day she took off one direction. I took off another direction. We were just pondering, praying about, just alone. So can you see a pattern here? I did the same thing in Ohio when I was trying to figure out. And ended up coming down from the mountain right to where the Provo Temple was. And this guy invited me in to take a tour.
So this man, somebody just come out of the woods and invites him into the house of God.
And so I went in. It was a silent tour. I got in the ceiling room, got my answer. You know, I had been praying for an answer.
Oh, my goodness.
Is this true? Got my answer. Made it back to that apartment where we were staying with those people, and Kathy had the same experience. So we knew we wanted to join the church. We hitchhiked back to Indiana, talked to the bishop there. We were going to get baptized there. He said, no, you need to live the gospel for a while, 6 months. We had already cleaned up, you know, we were keeping the commandments and stuff, but it, you know, we needed to demonstrate to ourselves and to the church that we could live the lifestyle.
And was that pretty common back then, or was he sort of making some of his own rules or qualifications? Because now, I mean, if someone wants to get baptized, right?
Well, especially a bishop doing that, because
that's
the wrong side of the font there.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't know whether it was.
But that's just what he told you. So you followed that advice?
And I'm so grateful for that advice. Hmm. So we hitchhiked back to Massachusetts. We got pretty active in the church there as non-members, and I was even assigned a home teacher and stuff.
And were you married at this point?
Not yet.
Oh, okay. All right.
In June, we were to be married back in Indiana. So we were baptized on June 8th of 72, and then we were married on June 10th by the bishop in my parents' backyard.
So coming from the lifestyle you had, was there really a tough adjustment for you, or it sounded like you're sort of just living freely and you just go with whatever flow comes, and that's the way the flow took you?
It was easier for me than it was for Kathy.
Okay.
Because I am just a flow with it kind of guy, you know, and I, when I get behind something, I go all in. And Kathy's more of a thinker. She's she thinks things through more carefully. She was okay with it, and she went along with it. But she has said many times, if she hadn't been with me, she doesn't think she would have been able to
Interesting.
Continue.
Okay. So then you're baptized, and this was in Indiana,
yep,
right?
Yeah.
And then went to Massachusetts after that?
No, after that, we knew that we couldn't live near any of our friends.
Oh, okay.
And make a go of our marriage or the gospel. So we literally got out a map and we picked out a town, Frankfort, Kentucky, and we loaded up our duffel bags and got on the Greyhound bus and had 100 and some bucks and went to Frankfort, Kentucky and found an apartment, found jobs and started.
And you had no social connection there. You
nothing,
just went.
Nothing.
And just you wanted to hit the big reset button in your life, huh?
Church was about 37 miles away. We went to see where church was so that we, you know, is it doable? We didn't have a car.
Yeah.
And we talked to some people and they said, well, you know, we live in Frankfort. Well, you can ride with us. We have plenty of room. And so when we showed up at church, I mean, we were barefooted. We were both barefooted, just scrub, you know, pretty scrubby looking and stuff.
Wow.
And, but they just took us in. It's just incredible.
And you did get married by this point.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just trying to keep it all straight in my head.
We got married 2 days after we were baptized.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Great. And so did you settle down there for a while in Kentucky?
Yeah. We lived in Frankfort for the first year. Then I took a position with a little company as a computer operator in Lexington. So we moved to Lexington, and that's where church was. Mm. So that made it a whole lot easier.
So how long did you live there?
We were in Lexington 10 years.
Wow. Okay. So, and maybe listeners may be listening to this like, wow, like we're sure getting into the very details of this, this person's life. But I think what happens in the coming years there is what's unique is you were made bishop at age of 22, even as a convert and as a young man, right?
Yeah. 3 years. I'd been a member 3 years when I was called as bishop.
So how did that happen? I don't mean that in an insulting way, but I'm just saying this is, it's an anomaly for sure.
We couldn't believe it either. You know, you often ask people, tell us about when you were called.
Yeah.
We knew our bishop was leaving and I was serving as elders quorum president. I had been an elders quorum president now all of 3 months and the stake president wanted to see me and my wife. And so on a Thursday night, went over there, and, you know, Kathy and I were talking. I'm too young to be a counselor in the bishopric. That can't, you know, that can't be it. I don't know, you know, what, yeah. I wonder what's happening here. Maybe there's just a domino thing going.
Yeah.
And he said, he called me to be the bishop. And Kathy said, are you sure? And he pulled out the letter from Spencer W. Kimball authorizing him to call me as a bishop. This was in 1975.
So was this, was it common to have a young bishop in that area?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, the next day I went to the bank and I saw one of my friends who's a member of the church. And he said, I just talked last night to a member of the high council. And he said the guy's name and I knew him. He said, when they announced our new bishop, everybody about fell off their chairs. So, no, it wasn't that common, and it was pretty tough for some folks.
Wow. I don't want to say, but was there just not a lot of people to choose from? I mean, what? Or was it just simply revelation that was out of nowhere?
Well, the ward has 700 members.
Oh, my goodness.
And a lot of them were college professors and a lot of professional students.
Hmm. Nice. Okay.
But there was a challenge in the ward because there were a lot of members who did not accept the leadership of the church, the local leadership of the church. There was a lot of angst between some members and the stake president.
And that was before you were called?
Yes.
And so now these members have to have to look at their 22-year-old bishop and and not have any angst with him, right?
But that's what kind of narrowed the field of possible people to call.
Oh, gotcha. So this, in a way, you were sort of fresh blood, and they didn't have a history with you to hate you. So maybe this was a.
I really do think there's some of that. Yeah.
Interesting. And of course, you know, I've never doubt the revelatory process and all this. I'm just, you know, I've been through that process of calling bishops and, you know, sometimes you're just looking at it from a practical, you know, standpoint. Well, who do we got? You know, who's on the list? And maybe there just wasn't a lot long list.
When I was released, the stake president said, "Let me tell you about when we called you." Hmm. He said, "We were off." The stake covered the whole half, the eastern half of Kentucky. So it was a huge stake. So they were, wow. The whole stake presidency was traveling, including the executive secretary and the clerk were traveling somewhere for, I don't know, a word conference or something. And so they were talking about who the bishop would be, and they talked about possibilities. And then he had everybody write down a name on a piece of paper, just anonymously, and then hand it to him. And he said, all five had my name on it.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's fascinating. So how long did you serve?
About 3.5 years. I was released so that I could go to college.
Typical problem. Yeah. The bishop's got to go to college. Let's release him. Okay. So during that time serving, I mean, obviously you're a new member. And so you didn't have that, you know, old gray-haired bishop as a youth that you could think back and think, oh, what would he do, right? Or how would he approach this problem? What dynamic did that bring that you just didn't have a history of knowing what bishops do? Or
it allowed me to be clean of some traditions, which I think was helpful.
And was that hard for your members to clean out those traditions? any specific tradition come to mind that they straightened out?
Well, one was my focus on the youth. Because everything I read, Kathy and I had served a little bit in the stake, young men and young women on the, I can't remember what the committee was called back then, but activities committee, services and activities committee. So we had gone to June conference the year before, which was the youth conference before they disbanded that. They used to have a special conference for youth leaders. And we went to that, and it was just drummed into us. Harold B. Lee was the president, and he was saying the first and foremost responsibility of bishops is the Aaronic priesthood and young women of corresponding age. And so I took that to heart, and I really focused on the youth. And I figured all these other people, they can just fight with each other all they want. I'm going to work with the youth. Mm. And we had some phenomenal things.
And so how, you know, what things did you ignore? Was it those, you know, member spats that sometimes surface or specific activities or how did you go about doing focusing on these?
I actually refused to be a judge in spats. I said, you're adults. You're going to have to work that out. I'm not going to do that. Uh-huh. And I look back now and I think, where did that boldness come from? That just did not. You know, all those factors, that does not make sense, but it was there, you know, it just was part of the mantle of the calling, I suppose. I don't take any credit for it. It just all came.
That's
because
great.
It needed to come. It needed to happen.
Yeah.
Probably the most rewarding thing in my whole service in the church was just a few years ago. I was a branch president in Wahoo, Nebraska on a special assignment. I didn't live there, but I was out there. And the church used to have a directory, you know, where you could see, it wasn't online back then, it was in a book. And I looked to see, who's the bishop of the ward back there? Well, I had had a guy, a young man who was a teacher when I was called as bishop, became a priest while I was there, who was a really renegade, and he was a rebel, and he did a lot of stuff. And he was, you know, I look back now, he's kind of a bully, and even the seminary and institute director who lived in our ward wanted him banned from seminary and stuff, but I wouldn't do it. And I worked with him, and I really cared for him. Well, when I looked at that directory, he was the bishop.
Oh, wow.
He was now the bishop, you know, many years later.
There's a payday for a bishop, right?
So I called him up, and he'd been bishop a couple of years, and here's what he said. Now that I've been bishop for a couple of years and I see all the pressures and the strains and the pulls, how was it that you made us feel like we were the only responsibility you had? Huh. That was a payday.
Yeah. So what did you, I mean, obviously maybe that's a whole book in itself, but how did you do that? How did you make them feel like they were your only responsibility?
Well, I had good counselors. I used executive secretary. I put the very best people I could working with the youth. I released one counselor who was an excellent counselor to be the young men's president because I wanted the best in there with those kids. I went to seminary. I participated in every activity. I went on I was always at youth conference and girls camp and all that stuff. I really wanted them to know that I loved them and that I recognized they were in a stage of a hinge part of their life. I failed my hinge part. I wanted them to be able to successfully make it through it.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Is there anything else notable about that first time as bishop that's worth mentioning? Sounds like it was a great experience. And then you had to go to college.
Yeah. Well, I guess a couple. One was we started a branch. We started back in Frankfurt where we first lived. We were able to grow the church out there, do some leadership training on some folks out there and start a branch. It's now a ward. It's doing great.
Oh, great.
The other thing was just George Durant. Do you know George Durant? Do you know who he is? BYU guy, written a lot of books. He was the mission president during most of that time. And every state conference used to be quarterly, and they were quarterly back then. And every state conference, he would look at me like, are you one of my missionaries? Nice. And a couple times he asked, and then after a while he figured it out.
Yeah, nice. So let's just go through real quick the timeline of the times you were bishop. So you're bishop at 22 and branch president, obviously. How long until the next time you were called as a bishop or branch president?
So I was released in 78. And then I was called to be branch president out in Wahoo. That had to have been in the 90s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that was you said branch president, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they formed a brand new branch out in Wahoo. It was pretty interesting.
And Wahoo, is that Kentucky or is that Nebraska?
This is Nebraska.
Oh, okay.
And it's about 45 miles away from our house. Okay. So I'd go out there and it was great. It was really fun. It was really small. As a matter of fact, of the youth, there were only two and they were brother and sister.
Oh, wow. So it was easy to focus on the youth. It took about 10 minutes and you were...
Well, what we ended up doing is I worked with stake president. We called 10 youth stake missionaries who were
interesting
from throughout the stake. And we picked the kind of the cream of the crop and we sent them out there too. So they attended church so that those two kids would not have to just have the church experience by themselves.
Oh, that's a great idea.
It was fantastic. And one of the things, and we kept them busy. So for instance, we would keep roll of who attended the Sunday block. And then anybody who did not attend, we divided up those names and we sent those youth out to visit them.
Oh, great.
So we called them Sunday home services. And so every member was either at church or had a visit from church every Sunday.
Wow.
And, and those kids just blossomed and did such great work. It was just phenomenal.
Nice. And then how long did you serve as branch president at that point?
About a year.
Okay.
That was it. My role was to train a couple counselors so that one of them can step up and be the branch president. Then I was called to be the stake mission president.
Oh, okay. Great. And then how long after that were you called again?
I served as stake mission president, let's see, 3 years. Then I was called to be the branch president of a branch of Sudanese refugees. These were refugees from Sudan who Omaha has the largest population of Sudanese refugees in the nation.
Oh, really? And that's still the case?
Yes.
Oh, wow. And why is that? Just the way that...
There's a lot of meat processing. And in Sudan, the main economy is based on cattle. Mm-hmm. And so they're skilled at butchering and all that stuff. So, and once some of them come, they have such a network, then everybody comes.
Gotcha. So, and So starting a branch, was there, why did they start the branch? Was there just a large or a group of Sudanese members that, that needed a place to worship?
Not really. I think it was started really for missionary work purposes, primarily.
Okay. Because there was so much opportunity to teach the Sudanese people that bringing them to a church that had other Sudanese there was beneficial to that process.
Yeah. Plus, they were all so destitute and in such dire straits that church was able to use a lot of resources to kind of help them.
And so, as you're serving these two times as branch president, you're still in the same home, and is that where you live now? Is you were in Omaha those times,
yes.
But then you were just called to these locations,
yes,
right?
That's right.
Okay, gotcha. So, what did you start that branch then with the Sudanese branch?
No, I did not. It started before me when I was stake mission president, and then I was involved with the missionary work. I was involved with them a lot. Then when Elder Perry came out and said, "You guys are going to have to quit spending so much fast offering funds."
Wow! So, well, tell me about that. So, Elder Perry, was he he was an apostle at that time?
Yes.
So, I mean, this was in the 80s, right?
Yes,
or 90s.
This was in the 90s.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And
late 90s.
So, did he? He come visit for this specific purpose to tell you to stop spending money?
No, he sent a letter to our stake president, and he said that you're expending $100,000 a year over your collections and fast offering. That's got to stop.
Interesting. So maybe there is a magical number. If you spend too much, you'll get a phone call or
over 3 years, 300,000.
Oh, wow.
And so then I was called to be branch president to make that happen.
Oh, okay. So you didn't cause that problem.
No.
But so how did you make that happen?
I learned to say no.
Gotcha. So, and bless the heart of whoever served before you. I'm sure that he was doing his best,
sure.
and striving to just, feed the poor and the needy with these sacred funds. Was he just simply not saying no ever, or?
Well, he was doing as he was instructed. The purpose, I believe, of the branch from the beginning was to be able to kind of pool some of the resources of the church to be able to help these people who were in need. The problem was we were just kind of abetting the problem. We were not solving anything. Mm-hmm. So they weren't converting from requiring welfare services to becoming independent.
Gotcha.
It was
so self-reliance
wasn't happening. Yeah.
Yeah. So was it a simple process of just letting them know that there's sort of a new sheriff in town and that you will be saying no more often, or and then you just had to prioritize the needs that came to you?
The word simple does not enter into this explanation. It was the hardest thing. And I'm not a say no kind of guy very much. And,
yeah. Oh,
it was so hard. And I just, but I had to say no all the time. And many people, see, they come from a very violent culture.
Yeah.
And so when they get frustrated or they get desperate, they turn to violence. And we had to cancel church many times because it was too dangerous. Because people
would just
come
get us.
Yeah, I got 9 death threats in one day.
Oh my gosh.
And it was relatively consistent, not that many every day, but very consistent that I was getting these death threats. So we had to spend about 2 weeks. We had to go out of state. The church was actually going to put us up in a hotel, a different hotel every night around Omaha. But we decided to go to Colorado. We had a grandson who was in the NICU unit there at the Children's Hospital in Denver. So we decided to go there, kind of let the smoke clear, and then come back.
So did you have any tense situations, anything break out like during church or?
Yes.
Oh, wow. And you just handled those the best you could?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Most of it was one-on-one. We didn't have anything that happened in front of a crowd or anything like that. But in my office,
yeah,
it happened a lot. And I, And our missionaries ran into it a lot too. And so I really worked with the missionaries to make sure that they're in tune with the Spirit. And as soon as the Spirit tells them to leave, leave. Don't think that you're going to be able to overcome this with reason and rationality because the emotions get too high. Just leave and then maybe come back 2 or 3 days or something. But
yeah. Wow. You know, my time serving as bishop, you know, I had a lot of, you know, welfare was definitely a focus in my service there. And, you know, there would be some tense moments that would break out in my office, you know, some not very happy with how I was approaching their need and how I would help them. And I always, and we had some mental illness in the ward that would sort of just, you know, be a catalyst to some of those tempers. And I remember just a line always being intentional about how I lay out my bishop's office that so that I can get to the door before somebody else can, right?
Oh,
the,
yeah.
The door is always to my back and they're not in between me and the door, right? Because you need an exit strategy there or letting, you know, your counselor, executive secretary know that, hey, if you hear something going on here, you can come in, you know, like don't feel like you can't interrupt.
No, definitely. We worked on that. We actually had someone who was on the High Council who was kind of a security person. And so we had him help us with the layout of the bishop's office and stuff.
Oh, interesting. And I always thought it was ironic that, you know, I would be in this ward that, you know, a lot of people sometimes get upset with me because of welfare, but nonetheless, hey, if you need my home address, it's on that envelope outside my office, you know?
Yeah.
And I always thought maybe I should get a P.O. box or something, but I just sort of, I'm sure it's fine. And I never did have a problem. There were a few times that an individual came to my home and I let them know clearly that this was inappropriate, that you don't come to my home to, you know, pester me about when the check's coming. This is that's sort of crossing the line, you know? So
with the Sudanese, luckily where we met was about a 15-20 minute drive or something like that. And none of them have transportation. We had to transport them everywhere.
Gotcha. So you sort of had that geographical barrier.
Yeah. I knew that they could be really, really mad at me. And if they had to get somebody to drive them out here, it's probably not going to happen.
Wow.
But for church, that's what we would do. We'd have our executive meetings. Then we would assign who's going to pick up whom. And sometimes you had to make 2 or 3 trips to pick people up. And because almost none of the members had transportation.
Interesting. Wow. What an experience. And bless your soul for putting up with it. And
it was a tough assignment, but you know, I learned a lot. I learned a lot. I'm grateful for the experience.
And then, like you mentioned, this time is your fourth time serving as bishop just happened last November, yep. Which would be November of 2015, right?
Yes.
So it's almost been a year.
Yep.
And did that come as a shock to you? I mean, this is maybe more of a traditional time serving as bishop. Would you say that?
I'm past that, actually. especially nowadays, you know, stake presidents are done 10 years before they get to be my age. But
oh, okay.
No, yeah, it was a bit of a surprise, but this time I just laughed.
Nice. <You're> like, I've had death threats as bishop. I can handle anything.
Frankly, I was really happy about it because you interviewed someone who did social media for public affairs, and I did that for a couple of years.
Jeff Thatcher. Uh-huh.
And I loved it. I really did enjoy it, but I was ready to get back in there. You know, I had been serving the institution of the church and working on the church's reputation and all that, but now I can go and help some people.
Yeah.
And I was really happy about getting back in there again.
Nice. And during that time, you attended your ward week to week, but as far as your calling, you were going to maybe coordinating councils and such to train on social media and public affairs things, right?
It is funny, though, that we've lived in this house for 20 years, and we were in one ward for 19 of those, and I really have only attended about 3 years.
Oh, right.
With all my various assignments.
Yeah, you've been called as branch president, different next of the woods, right?
So. Yeah, and, you know, area calling and, you know, all different kinds of stuff. So
Wow. Well, that's fantastic. And as we've gone through this, we've hit on a few of your leadership principles, I think. But maybe let's just go through these, as I do with these How I Lead interviews, is ask those that I interview to just sit down and think, what are the five leadership principles that you're living by, that you try and apply to your calling, and how's that helped you? So let's just go through these. The first one he said is shake it up, break free of some traditions. And you talked about this to the original time, the first time you were as bishop, you sort of got rid of some of those traditions, right?
Yeah, because I didn't know they were traditions, partly.
Yeah.
But now it's more intentional. You know, that's what Joseph Smith's one of his main roles was to fight the traditions, the unhealthy traditions of his age. And yeah. I think a lot of people work on too much on autopilot in the church. Mm. And so I do things. For instance, when I conduct, I always welcome, good morning, sisters and brothers.
Nice.
I just flip it just to catch people's attention.
Yeah, that's a simple way to do that.
Yeah,
right?
And now they're listening a little bit more. We have a ward theme every year, and I know a lot of wards do that. Ours this year is deepening our acceptance of the atonement of the Savior. And so we have a ward theme hymn. So we sing the ward theme hymn at least a couple times a month. It's I Stand All Amazed, which ties to the ward theme. Now for 2017, we'll probably have a different theme and we'll have a new theme hymn.
Oh, interesting. I never heard of a ward theme hymn, but that's a great idea. Another way to just remind people of what your focus is.
Exactly. You know, I make up callings. we had a brother who had not really been active in 30 years, and he'd been pretty mean to people quite a bit. And I befriended him long before I was called as bishop. And I thought, we've got to get him in. And the time was right in his life. So, you know, I'm not taking any credit for this. The time was right in his life. I called him to be the sacrament coordinator. We didn't have any priests.
And this was when he was still inactive.
He'd started coming out some.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't completely out of left field when you gave him a calling. Okay.
But I was limited on what I could do, what I could call him to do because of his, you know, there were some things.
Yeah.
Anyway, called him to be the sacrament coordinator. So he would help. He would do the preparation. He would bless the sacrament and arrange for people to bless the sacrament. We had a deacon's quorum president who would handle the getting people to pass. He took that responsibility so seriously. And the tough challenge for him was I said, we're going to do all gluten-free bread.
Wow. Was there somebody, I mean, it wasn't, we had just a lot, on a health.
Oh no, we have a lot of members who have gluten intolerance. And so, and in the previous ward, they had a special tray and they would go take it to those people and call attention to those people and all that stuff. I said, let's just go all gluten-free.
Interesting.
And so we lined the trays with paper towels and we're just all, we're all gluten-free. And there are some people not happy about that. And this poor brother had to bear some of the brunt of that. But
interesting. And so you just get that from the store or does somebody actually bake that?
We got it from the store.
Oh, okay. Nice. And wow, that's a great way to approach it. Just
So he took that very seriously.
Hmm.
And he did that for many months. And then a few months ago, about 3 months ago, I called him in and I said, I have a new calling for you. I'd like you to be the temple coordinator. There are a lot of members of our ward who need to be going to the temple more, but there are obstacles. I'd like for you to coordinate ways to overcome those obstacles. I'd like you to be the temple coordinator. He said, Bishop, I don't have a temple recommend. How can I ask people to do this if I can't do it myself? And I said, well, we're not going to announce your calling until you have a temple recommend.
Oh, great.
Are you willing? And he said, after much discussion, he said, yes. And then on the following Sunday, he confirmed it. I'm going to do this. I'm in. So two Tuesdays ago, he returned to the temple.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It was just one of those nights. We had 21 ward members there with him to show him support. It was beautiful. His wife said, "I've been waiting 30 years for this."
Oh, wow. What a blessing. That's great. So the second principle you mentioned is treat the ward council as senior executives.
Trust their revelation. I let them run their organizations as much as I can. I get them involved. You know, they have a ward-wide calling, not just an organization calling. And I think I learned it from your podcast, actually. When I issue the call to someone to be, say, the young men's president, I say, I'm calling, you know, the Lord would have you serve in our ward council with a special assignment as the president of the young men.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that came from a How I Lead interview. I can't think off the top of my head who it was, but yeah, I thought that was a great...
It was
I almost
a
want to
great
say
tip.
It was the stake president. But anyways.
It was a great tip. That was a great tip.
Great.
And so they're involved in the sacrament meeting planning. We're getting better and better. We're figuring all this out. And we try to make sure that all the sacrament meetings are following our ward theme hymn pretty heavily. The ward council, every time we meet twice a month. We have sister missionaries here who are really go-getters. So I gave them a list of 71 families. I think it was 70 families or so who most of us didn't know. And I wanted them to visit them, kind of get the lay of the land. And then in ward council, they gave us five families that they recommend that we work on. So we give out assignments for a ward council member to visit or, you know, whatever, each one of those families. And then we report on the ones that were assigned 2 weeks ago. And that's gone really well. Now, that's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to flip that around and have the ward council members telling the sister missionaries, here are the five that we'd like for you to go see. Mm. But, you know, baby steps, right?
Yeah, so you empower your ward council to act in their calling, and they're not always second guessing themselves according to what the bishop says or what the bishop wants me to do.
That's right, and even with the ward theme, they picked it. I didn't pick it. As a matter of fact, the bishop had something else in mind, and in ward council, as we discussed it over the course of two or three meetings. They decided on the atonement of Christ. And I'm so grateful for that because I've had so many people because of that focus come in, confess things that have been lingering for years. It was definitely inspired and it came from the ward council.
And can you think of maybe a situation or a time when that's been difficult, when you've maybe seen an auxiliary leader headed down a path that isn't going to end well and you sort of have to restrain yourself from swooping in and saving the situation?
Well, I have one right now, actually. we've lost a counselor in one of the organizations, and we're working on who should replace that person. And my counselor and the president of that organization don't agree.
Hmm.
And I'm trying to not step in yet.
Right.
And so,
there may be a time. So
I've told them that I really want them. I want to give them another week. Really like for you to be comfortable and unified in your nomination of who should be that counselor.
That's great.
You know, and I'm really hoping that it does not end up meaning that I have to make the decision that they'll make the decision.
Yeah.
The only time
for sure.
I intervene is when I have two organizations who've had revelations for the same person.
Yeah. Yeah. Next one, he said, I like this one. It says, focus less on Sunday business and more on Sunday worship.
Yeah. We do no interviews during the block. None of us. We don't treat Sunday school class as a holding pen for interview candidates. We go to class. We worship. We have no meetings longer than an hour. No business executive meetings longer than an hour. And I've heard you talk about that before, too.
You're speaking to my heart, David.
Yeah. It's a very rare exception that we have a pulpit announcement. We almost never have a pulpit announcement. We have a really good person who does our word bulletin. We have an email that goes out every week to every member who has put their email address out there. We have a Facebook page. And so, you know.
Yeah. That's one thing we're trying to tackle right now. And my stake is you know, doing those announcements at the beginning of sacrament meeting. And it's such a tradition, right? It's just something I can't remember a time when that hasn't happened in, you know, in my time in the church. But that's sort of the direction we're getting from our area authorities and such. And it still sort of happens because, I mean, conducting a meeting, it's sort of awkward. You sort of want something to sort of kick the football off. You know, in other words, you just want sort of warm up. Let's warm up with a few announcements, you know.
But that sends us back to number one, shake it up and break free of some tradition.
Yeah, exactly, right?
So I love it.
Yeah, and the reality is, you know, sometimes the bishoprics look at us like, well, you know, these are important announcements. We want the people to know. And I always... And I agree with that, but now there's so many ways to do that more effectively, where in reality, you know, half the ward isn't there at the beginning of sacrament meeting anyways, you know, in a typical ward. I don't mean to generalize, but, you know, what about all those people that come in late or after the sacrament, or, you know, it's not getting to them. And so is it really?
Yeah. And they're jostling with their kids, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. So, you know, they're not, and that's another reason why you want to shake it up so that people are using their conscious mind when they're listening.
Yeah. And I've seen that there's a ward in my stake that does a ward Facebook group and does a fantastic job to communicate things. And I'm a member of it just to follow it and see what's happening. And you know, there is, if someone needs a ride, they'll go to there and say, hey, I need a ride on Sunday. Is it someone can help me out? Or, you know, and obviously you don't want to get too carried away with those. Obviously, you know, you hope they call home teaching and things, but nonetheless, like putting an announcement there on Facebook,
yep,
man, that guarantees people are going to see it.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. A good example of this philosophy of focus less on Sunday business, my ward clerk this Sunday texted me and said he wouldn't be in bishopric meeting this week. And so he didn't say why. When it came to sacrament meeting, he said, I had a choice. I could either go to sacrament meeting or I could go to bishopric meeting. I chose sacrament meeting. I said, that's, you know, good choice, that's huh? what I want. You know, that's exactly what I'm looking for.
Yeah. And you know, you talk about being present in Sunday school and during that 3-hour block. And I would agree with you. So it's crucial to, as far as from a leadership standpoint. And I think there's some bishoprics out there that would disagree with that, you know, and that's, you know, to each their own. But because it is tempting, you know, to use that as a holding pin to some of these, you know, everybody's there. I can hurry and grab this person, that person. And you look at it like, well, I can take a half hour now and save me 3 hours during the week.
No, it's
you
true.
Know, but yeah. But there's something about that leader being present in the meeting and participating and obviously presiding and helping the teacher that maybe's, you know, looking as everybody stares at the carpet, maybe that leader can raise his hand and contribute, you know, and kind of save that teacher in those moments when you can, they're obviously struggling with engaging the class. Right. So a great principle. This next one, you've definitely touched on. I don't know if there's more to say. We say adults can take care of themselves, focus on the youth. And going back to your first time as a bishop, that was sort of the motto you followed. And obviously it impacted the youth greatly that they even remember that today. So anything else to say along those lines?
And when I have my executive secretary set up interviews with the youth, I have them set 45 minutes.
Oh, wow.
I don't want to rush them.
Hmm.
I generally set a half an hour for an interview, which is probably longer than what most bishops do, but I want to listen. I want to ask questions. I want to really get to know people. And so I allow extra time for youth.
That's great. That's great. Number five, you said, let counselors and ward council handle the organization and you, the bishop, can minister. Anything else to say on those lines?
Well, a lot of it's about autonomy. Let people work things out, you know. I also, one thing we didn't mention is I travel. And so I'm gone all week, most weeks.
Oh, wow.
And so I only have the weekends most of the time. I've cut back a little bit since I've been bishop. So I don't travel quite as much as I did, but at least every other week I'm gone. So number one, not using the Sunday block for interviews is very tempting. Break that rule. But also, I need people to know they can make decisions. And so I need to give them a lot of autonomy to be able to make those decisions. Now, as far as ministering is concerned, number one, I've taken a lot of coaching classes, and I actually got certified as a coach in partly for church service so that I could be a better listener and help people arrive at their own counsel, you know, dig deep, because the Holy Ghost can do a better job than I can.
Yeah.
But I also, you know, I spend a lot of time texting people. I have a member with just a horrible addiction. It relapses pretty often. And he texts me right as soon as he's had a relapse. I'm always sending scriptures, thoughts from reading Ensign articles and stuff like that. So I spend a lot of time doing little one-on-one things for people.
Yeah. That you can even do from a distance, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that, your fifth principle there. I remember when I was called as the first counselor in a bishopric, and the bishop saying to me, I want you to make decisions. And it's just a simple phrase, but nonetheless, it empowered me, because I wanted to be that meek counselor that, you know, followed the bishop's guidance and did what he wants. But by him saying that, I was in situations where he wasn't right there, and I felt empowered to make those decisions, you know. And when I was bishop, I called this my Bishop Smiley principle, that I wanted to be that bishop who's just always smiling in the back, like so caring, having time for members as they come back and shake my hand and have a question for me. And then I want my counselors being the ones that are running around frantic with, you know, the fire extinguishers and doing those things. So such a strong principle to, you know, let them handle the organization, the administering, so that you can minister. It's powerful.
The other challenge with that is the tradition of the bishop gets counsel, we all sustain it, which again, I'm not disagreeing with that at all. The problem is sometimes we just make suggestions and people take it as counsel.
Yeah.
And so you have to be really careful about what you say, or people just start writing it down and they start doing that.
Right.
And so people quit thinking and they just do what they're told. And so we're still working on that. And with this ward council, they're fantastic. They're the best ward council I've ever seen. But still, sometimes they follow what I say because of the chair I'm sitting in. Because, you know, they know about being called of God, and they their hearts are right.
Yeah.
But we've got to work with them to still think and to think. And they're in a position, when you're in a ward council, you're in a position to really think things through and then make suggestions and make decisions.
Yeah, I think that's great. Giving permission to make decisions, giving permission to disagree with the bishop. And I would do that a lot with my counselors. I plead with them to push back on them. Tell me why I'm wrong if you see it, because that's where the revelation is going to kick in. Well, David, this has been fantastic. You know, I appreciate you allowing me to spend a little more time on your story and your background, because I think it's just inspiring and an incredible story. You know, being a hippie at 18, baptized at 19, and a bishop at 22. You know, I don't know if there's a similar story in the church, but if there is, I'd love to hear about it. So, but David, as you've thought back, even way back when you were 22, again, not way back, you're not that old, okay, but as you look back when you're 22 and since then have several opportunities, now your fourth time serving as a branch president or bishop, how have those opportunities of service made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
Well, you know, that one's a hard answer, and a lot of your people have stumbled on how to answer that. I've chosen, you know, I have two or three that I could tell you, but the one I've chosen to tell you is that our goal is not to get people active in church. Activity in church is a tool. Our goal is to help people continually deepen their relationship with the Savior and to become more fully, to more fully accept His atonement. You know, those are the goals. And the church is the mechanism to help people do that. So we don't stop once they get active in the church. A lot of our work continues to be able to help them then grow in their love for and their relationship with the Savior. We don't stop with the tools. You know, nurturing doesn't end once they've received all the ordinances and that they remain active in church. The nurturing must continue.
Concludes my interview with David DeFord. I sure hope you appreciate as much as I did his story, his conversion and his background and how the gospel changed his life, even to the point that 3 years later, he was able to jump in and be that bishop that he was needed to be at that moment. Really inspiring story, and to go on and serve three other times as either branch president or bishop. And I hope you found this interview as interesting as I did. So I'm interested to know, do you have an interesting background, or do you know somebody who has a unique background in leadership or something that led up to leadership? Because I think those are some fun interviews to do, right? It's not that David's background made him a better bishop than other bishops, but nonetheless, it's unique and it's fun to learn about and to see how people approach these callings with their own unique limitations, right? And their own unique backgrounds. And it's inspiring to see that it all works out and we're sanctified through these processes and we become better human beings and become more like our Father in heaven. So it's fun to learn about. So if you know of anybody who has a unique background or you yourself, don't be hesitant. Don't be bashful. Email me and say, hey, if you'd like me to share my story, I'd love to participate in that. And we can set a time and get it done. And as always, like I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, all we ask is $1 a month for the content that we put out on Leading LDS. And I ask you, really ask yourself, if you've not contributed, ask yourself why. If it is because, well, I can't figure out on the website where to contribute, well, then email me. I'll send you the link. But I've hopefully made it much easier. And as we get the nonprofit paperwork in place, I'm going to put a big flashing donate button on the homepage. And so then it'll be really easy to find. But seriously, we could really use your contribution to that. And I realize many of you are busy and don't have time to give. And so giving that $1 a month is something you can do. And more than likely, you can afford it. And if you simply think, well, you know what? I'm not giving $1 a month because this hasn't been that helpful, then email me and tell me that, because I want to make this to a point that anybody listening would be willing to give $1 a month to what we're doing, because we can make a big difference in enhancing the leadership ability in the church and moving the kingdom of God forward. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.